Randy Best received a BA from Grinnell College and a master's degree from Harvard University. He's also a graduate of the Humanist Institute, a certified mediator, and pastoral counselor. He served previously as the leader of the Ethical Humanist Society of the Triangle, which is in North Carolina, and now serves the Northern Virginia Ethical Society. In addition to his work in ethical culture, Randy works at Duke University as the administrative director of the physics department. Right? Did I get that right?
Emeritus.
We welcome him so much to our society today. He's going to talk about the fragility of our democracy. So please join me in welcoming Randy Best.
It's my pleasure to be here today to talk to old friends and new. How fragile is American democracy? Growing up, I always thought of American democracy as strong and secure. My parents were on the far left of the political spectrum. In national elections, my mother usually compromised and voted for the Democratic candidate. I remember my father voting for more leftist candidates, often from the socialist or communist parties. I saw my parents as an example that America tolerated minority political views. American democracy seemed to be broad enough and diverse enough to allow dissent and keep on keeping on. However, American democracy was not as inclusive as it seemed. As a child in the early 1960s, I was puzzled by the conflict surrounding the struggle for civil rights. Why was American democracy, the beacon of freedom for the world, directly engaged in supporting racial segregation and denying civil rights? Such behavior belied the shiny American democracy that I had heard described in my history and civics lessons. I slowly came to realize that American democracy was not working the same way for everyone. In spite of this realization, I found comfort in the ideals of American democracy, and I still do. Personal liberty, checks and balances, separation of powers, one person, one vote. One person, one vote. I remember when I first learned about the Electoral College, I found it puzzling. Asking my teacher about it produced a confused response that the Electoral College was a political artifact, and it was unlikely nowadays for a president to get elected without getting the most votes. It had happened long ago in 1876 with Rutherford B. Hayes, and again in 1888 with Benjamin Harrison, but it's not likely to happen again. I guess that my ninth grade civics teacher was not a good prognosticator, since it happened twice recently, in 2000 with George W. Bush, and in 2016 with Donald Trump. Who could have known? My own political engagement began with opposing the Vietnam War. I saw firsthand how dissent could be met with violent response by the state. The Vietnam War sharply divided the country and continued to do so long after it ended. Howard Zinn wrote, "I was astonished, bewildered. This was America, a country where, whatever its faults, people could speak, write, assemble, demonstrate without fear. It was in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. We were a democracy. But I knew it wasn't a dream. There was a painful lump on the side of my head. The state and its police were not neutral referees in a society of contending interests. They were on the side of the rich and the powerful. From that moment on, I was no longer a liberal, a believer in the self-correcting character of American democracy. I was a radical, believing that something fundamental was wrong with this country, not just the existence of poverty amidst great wealth, not just the horrible treatment of black people, but something rotten at the root. The situation required not just a new president or new laws, but an uprooting of the old order, the introduction of a new kind of society, cooperative, peaceful, egalitarian." I tend to agree with Howard Zinn's views. Yet during the domestic conflict over the Vietnam War, American democracy endured. Politics marched on through the scandals of Richard Nixon's Watergate and Bill Clinton's sexual escapades. Somewhere along the line, I lost focus. I became complacent. I was doing all right. I thought that progress for civil rights was continuing. I was hopeful when Barack Obama was elected president, not realizing that while I felt hope, others were experiencing a shimmering resentment. My hope was short-lived. After midterm elections, Obama faced a Congress where the stated mission of the Republican majority was to defeat any legislation that the president proposed. The birther conspiracy continued to question Obama's legitimacy by claiming that he was not born in this country. Like a true conspiracy theory, no amount of evidence would shake this belief. An alarming number of people also believe that Obama was a covert Muslim. Many Americans could not accept that Barack Obama, a black man, could legitimately be president. It was easy for me to see these views as confined to the loony fringe, only championed by blowhards and publicity seekers on the political margins, like InfoWars' Alex Jones, Fox News' Bill O'Reilly, and Donald Trump's Donald Trump. I failed to anticipate where American democracy would go in the 2016 presidential election. Looking at the current state of American politics, I see unprecedented division and polarization, which led to the election of a president with unapologetic racist, misogynist, and xenophobic attitudes and authoritarian tendencies. To say that American democracy is facing new challenges understates the problem. Partisan divisions are more entrenched than ever. Congress is even more dysfunctional, unable to compromise to pass needed legislation like immigration reform, or even engage in civil disagreement. Mark Twain quipped, "If the opposite of pro is con, what is the opposite of progress?" American democracy is a mess. Okay, American democracy is inherently a messy process, but it has now been taken to the extremes. Listening to today's news leads me to believe that American democracy isn't working very well and may indeed be in serious trouble. American democracy is imperiled by the election of a president with pronounced authoritarian tendencies. Depending on how this plays out, American democracy may emerge in much worse shape. American journalist and satirist H.L. Mencken wrote in the 1930s, "As democracy is perfected, the office of the president represents more and more closely the inner soul of the people. On some great and glorious day, the plain folks of the land will reach their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be adorned by a downright moron."
Can you read it again?
As democracy is perfected, the office of president represents more and more closely the inner soul of the people. On some great and glorious day, the plain folks of the land will reach their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be adorned by a downright moron. Mencken may have been a better prognosticator than my ninth grade civics teacher. Donald Trump rode a wave of white working class populist resentment and white Republican intransigence into the White House, promising to drain the swamp of corruption and make America great again. A recent Journal of Politics paper, "The Changing Norms of Racial Political Rhetoric and the End of Racial Priming," by Nicholas Valentino and others, addressed the white resentment that contributed to Trump's victory. He wrote, "Following the civil rights movement and the partisan realignment of the 1970s and 80s, we began to slide back into the same patterns as before. where race and racial animus were quite central to the ways parties organized themselves. We are now seeing the consequences of that realignment come to full fruition. These historical forces, therefore, are probably far greater than any one or two presidents could fundamentally alter. This doesn't mean that we're back in a pre-civil rights mode of politics, more like an echo. Whites are now more likely to believe that they are part of a coherent group that is experiencing discrimination, which in their eyes legitimizes claims against outgroups, such as Muslims, blacks, and immigrants. Privilege is always precarious, but the more it is felt to be so, the more dangerous it threatens to become. I will not attempt to fully discuss the many forces that coalesce to elect Donald Trump. My question is, does an authoritarian president present a danger to the continuation of American democracy? The answer I find, to quote Sarah Palin, is, you betcha. Now that you have the answer, you're free to tune out the rest of my talk if you wish. I always thought that the loss of democracy was accompanied by violence in the streets, explosions, and the whoop, whoop, whoop of helicopters, and the other sounds of a military coup. But democracy can die slowly, in a series of small steps. Ironically, loss of democracy can also come through the electoral process, through a gradual erosion of freedoms, as you can see in Turkey today. The trappings of democracy may remain, elections may still be held, but political power has become so centralized that democracy is but a shadow. I believe that having an authoritarian president presents a danger to American democracy. I classify Donald Trump as an authoritarian because he sure seems to act like it. Trump also meets the four key indicators of authoritarian behavior outlined in the book How Democracies Die by Steven Levinsky and Daniel Ziblatt. The authoritarian criteria are, 1, rejection of or weak commitment to democratic rules of the game. Do they attempt to undermine the legitimacy of elections, for example, by refusing to accept credible results? On the campaign trail, Trump repeatedly said that the election was rigged and could be stolen. After being elected by the Electoral College, Trump maintained that he did not win the popular vote due to massive voter fraud. In an attempt to prove voter fraud, Trump established the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. It was created in May of 2017 after Trump's unsubstantiated claims that 3 to 5 million people fraudulently voted in the 2016 election. The commission's first formal act was to request the state's voter registration lists, which the states refused to provide. Some had partial compliance, some refused completely, and the great state of Mississippi responded by saying, hell no. The formal charge of this committee was to investigate those vulnerabilities in voting systems and practices used for the federal elections that could lead to improper voter registrations and improper voting, including fraudulent voter registrations and fraudulent voting. And despite these charges, the commission was able to come up with no evidence whatsoever. And on January 3rd, 2017, the White House press release disbanding the commission read, despite substantial evidence of voter fraud, many states have refused to provide the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity with basic information relevant to its inquiry. Rather than engage in endless political battles, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to dissolve the commission, and he asked the Department of Homeland Security to review its initial findings and determine the next course of action. It's like the prophet Mick Jagger said, you can't always get what you want. Authoritarian criteria number 2, denial of the legitimacy of political opponents. Do they basely describe their partisan rivals as criminals whose supposed violation of the law disqualifies them from full participation in the public arena? Crooked Hillary, lock her up, I need say no more. Authoritarian criteria number three, toleration or encouragement of violence. Have they tacitly endorsed violence by their supporters by refusing to unambiguously condemn it and punish it? Trump voiced support for violence in his campaign rallies. On multiple occasions, he called for the violent eviction of protesters at these rallies. He offered to pay any legal expenses related to the evictions. And then there was Charlottesville. Trump saw violence in Charlottesville as provoked by protesters, and for almost a week, he refused to condemn it. Authoritarian criteria number four, readiness to curtail civil liberties of opponents, including media. Have they supported laws or policies that restrict civil liberties, such as expanded libel or defamation laws? Are laws restricting protest, criticism of the government? Have they threatened to take legal or other punitive action against critics and in rival parties, civil society, or the media? Have they praised repressive measures taken by other governments, either in the past or elsewhere in the world? Check, check, and check. With the exception of Richard Nixon, no major party presidential candidate met even one of these four authoritarian criteria over the last century. Trump has met them all. I found this conclusion to be depressing, not surprising, but depressing. To lighten my mood, I searched for an authoritarian joke on the internet. This was all I could find. What do you call an authoritarian potato? A dictator. A spud king. A fricist. A baby authoritarian potato. A dictator tot. I guess authoritarianism just isn't very funny. Tragicomic, maybe. Given that America has an authoritarian president, as measured by those four criteria, is it a threat to American democracy? The conventional political wisdom that American political institutions will serve as a buffer to restrain an authoritarian president may not be as certain as it was once believed to be. The overall atmosphere is not promising. Not surprisingly, an authoritarian president was elected at a time when political institutions were not functioning well. The political divide has expanded to become a chasm, and even though one party controls the White House and both houses of Congress, political stagnation is the new normal. When the political institutions are weak, when Congress is unable to govern well, when the president questions the integrity of the FBI and the Department of Justice, American democracy has become less robust. Where will this take us? Brian Kloss, the author of The Despot's Accomplice, How the West is Aiding and Abetting the Decline of Democracy, and more recently the book The Despot's Apprentice, Donald Trump's Attack on Democracy, provides four possible scenarios, ranging in order from the most optimistic to the most cataclysmic. In Kloss's first scenario, it's called the Trump vaccine. If the backlash against Trump is robust enough, he could end up acting like a vaccine for American democracy. Perhaps he will galvanize enough opposition that more political norms are enshrined into law and civic engagement becomes resurgent. In this hopeful scenario, citizens deploy to the ramparts and defend democracy. The second scenario he calls democratic decay. This is the most likely scenario, he says. America's democratic sandcastle doesn't get washed away, but it is severely damaged as wave after wave hits its walls. The damage will be gradual, but it will add up. Even if Trump's presidency is a failure, he can still poison the minds of millions of people to hold authoritarian views, and the damage will take decades to repair, if it's possible to repair at all. Klass's third scenario he calls the forerunner. In this scenario, Trump paves the way for an even more dangerous successor. This person, a Trump 2.0, will have the authoritarian instincts of Donald Trump, but the polished smoothness of Barack Obama and the people skills of Ronald Reagan. With Trump normalizing authoritarian behavior, Trump 2.0 can do even more damage. Look at those candidates at the next presidential election and see. Finally, Klass presents the prospect of American authoritarianism. If a person like Trump is in office in the aftermath of a mass casualty terror attack, a widespread war, or a nuclear nightmare, it's possible that the American democracy could die with a bang. This is, thankfully, the least likely scenario, but it's not impossible. Donald Trump is too often compared to Adolf Hitler. I find this comparison to be offensive. It diminishes the experience of the millions who suffered from Hitler's crimes and ambition. Trump may exhibit autocratic tendencies, but he's no dictator. Not yet, anyway. Paraphrasing Tim McCarthy, the salient question isn't whether Trump is our Hitler. It is whether we're those Germans. I'm not content to sit by and watch the unfolding of a political spectacle that may end in disaster. But what can I do? Alexis de Tocqueville wrote in Democracy in America in 1835, "There is nothing more arduous than the apprenticeship of liberty. Such is not the case with despotism. Despotism often promises to make amends for 1,000 previous ills. The nation is lulled by the temporary prosperity that it produces until it is roused to a sense of its own misery. Liberty, on the contrary, is generally established with difficulty in the midst of storms." Ronald Reagan said, someone who I generally don't quote, "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We don't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same, or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States when we were free." What can I do to oppose the move to despotism and promote democracy? I must increase my level of civic engagement and persuade others to do so as well. I must work to get out the vote. Almost 40% of eligible voters did not vote in the 2016 election. What would the outcome have been if more people voted? I am making a commitment to help get out the vote. The current political situation threatens basic democratic rights and principles. There is a desperate need for a nonpartisan, pro-democratic coalition focused on fair elections, nonpartisan electoral districts, and universal voter registration. I am committing myself to finding more such organizations to support. I need to stay out of the sandbox and refrain from political behavior such as name-calling, vilifying opponents, and deliberately misrepresenting positions and motives of those that I disagree with politically. I must act to encourage a return to the former norms of political discourse. Political polarization and divisive scorched earth politics will not go away overnight. If being elected and holding power are your only ends, all else is optional. I must resist adopting the tactics that I abhor. I need to model consideration and respect for others, even politicians, even those I disagree with. I must overcome my reluctance and begin to talk, in nice ways, about my political values with others. It is a mistake to consider my civic engagement as a private matter. I must be willing to talk and to educate, and to be prepared to receive contrary opinion and negative feedback. Finally, I must work with others in coalition to be more effective in mutual support to avoid despair. Ryan Kloss concludes The Despot's Apprentice with these words. And I get a drink of water first, so I'm ready. Trump, like demagogues and despots throughout history, has tried to wrap himself in the American flag. He conflates critics with traitors, labels dedicated patriots as deep state infiltrators, and paints those who seek to improve the government as enemies who hate America. The American flag stands for precisely the opposite spirit to that of Trump's vicious attacks. It stands for the most powerful idea of all, the freedom of a citizen to protest a man like Trump, to speak out and to work to build a better democracy without being ostracized, beaten, or tortured. Loyalty to America does not mean loyalty to Trump. He is acting like a despot's apprentice, borrowing tactics from authoritarian leaders I've seen elsewhere. It could happen here. Trump has put our democracy at risk, and in this moment of democracy in peril, he reminds us that we must sometimes fulfill the most important and often the most difficult duties of true patriots, to dissent and oppose. So, I will not normalize the atrocious actions of the Trump presidency and his administration. I will work to change the balance of power in the upcoming midterm elections by supporting progressive candidates. And I hope that the Democratic Party will abandon its corporate leanings and finally get on board. American democracy is more fragile than I ever imagined it could be. I am still naive enough to believe that I can make a difference, and I'm dedicated to trying. Thank you.